This episode is being released during the week of Hanukkah, so happy Hanukkah to everybody out there today. Today's episode really looks at the essence of the purpose of Jewish education. What is it really there to achieve? And if you are one of those people that believes that the purpose of Jewish education is to ensure that our young people look just like the older people that came before them, be warned, today's episode might flip that paradigm on its head and give you something to think about during this fascinating conversation with Rabbi B'nai Lappi.
This is Adapting, the Future of Jewish Education, a podcast from the Jewish Education Project, where we explore the big questions, challenges, and successes that define Jewish education. I'm David Breifman.
Hi, everybody. I am so excited to be here today speaking with Rabbi B'nai Lappi, the president and Rosh Yeshiva at Savara, a traditionally radical yeshiva. I'm going to go into a bit of the biography about Rabbi Lappi, but as you'll see, she's going to speak for herself about many of the things that we will be engaging in today's conversation. But I think it is important to mention that she was ordained by the Jewish Theological Seminary in 1997 and founded Savara in 2003. She is well acquainted with podcasts because she is also a senior fellow at the Institute for the Next Jewish Future in Chicago. And some of you have been listening to some of the podcasts that have emerged from there. But it is really my pleasure to have Rabbi Lappi onto today's show to welcome her. And I'm sure we're all going to have a great conversation today. So welcome, B'nai.
Thank you, David. I'm so honored and flattered to be here. Very excited.
Well, today's episode is actually being dropped or launched during the holiday of Hanukkah. I wanted to start with that as a framing for our conversation today and simply ask you the question of what does Hanukkah mean to you? And then to extend the question as to why do you think Hanukkah is one of the most widely celebrated holidays amongst American Jews?
You know, I have a relationship to Hanukkah as just a person and a different relationship to Hanukkah as a rabbi. I love Hanukkah. It's one of my favorite Jewish holidays, mostly because it's just so much fun. And I remember as a kid, all six of us, I have four siblings and my parents, we would pile into my father's Volkswagen Beetle and I'd be in the rumble seat. And a highlight of Hanukkah, or the time around Hanukkah, but for me, it felt like a Hanukkah thing, was to drive into another neighborhood in Chicago called Sauganash, where we would look at Christmas lights. And I always associate this with Hanukkah and not Christmas, not only because the holidays come near each other, but because I always envied the giant displays of light and the decorations for Christmas that we didn't have for Hanukkah. And I always wanted that kind of thing for Hanukkah. We had a very modest menorah in our window. You know, we had the paper decorations and the banners inside the house. But the sense was it's not safe to really display Hanukkah out in the world. And it was only later, when I went to rabbinical school and learned more about Hanukkah as an adult, that I realized that Pirsum Manisa, the publicizing of the miracle, is actually one of the mitzvahs of Hanukkah. And now, also because, you know, we're some 50 years on in the world and the anti-Semitism in Skokie, Illinois and in Chicago isn't what it was, I feel totally free to have the kind of, what's that movie, the National Lampoon movie about the guy who decorates his house and all the Christmas things. Anyway, if you came to my house during Hanukkah, which I hope you will someday, you'll see all the lights all over my lawn and in our windows. It's a pretty spectacular thing. That's my relationship, that and present, the fun of it as an individual. As a rabbi and someone who thinks about the Jewish future, I love Hanukkah because it's the ultimate holiday of choose your own adventure. It's the choose your own story holiday. It's the holiday that I think makes the most visible, if you poke into the history, the story that we originally told, you know, the oil, the miracle. And then the story that we, I wouldn't say replaced that with, but added to it. And once Israel happens, now Hanukkah is about the Maccabees, and we kind of excavate that from our history where we had formerly thrown it away. And then, you know, you get little foil chocolate Maccabees, and now it's about being the underdogs and taking up arms and being brave and soldierly, which was definitely a story the rabbis of old wanted to suppress. So the idea that, you know, the holidays are telling the story we need to tell in this moment, I think is really interesting about Hanukkah. And I think we're actually in need of a new story. I think Hanukkah is just sitting here waiting for the compelling story of, you know, 2021.
So I think this is this is already beginning to open up a whole lot of questions, and we'll go into them in a bit more depth in a few moments. Growing up in Australia, Hanukkah was always the first holiday signifying the beginning of summertime. So knowing Hanukkah as a summer holiday was very interesting. And then juxtaposing it here within the Northern Hemisphere as a winter holiday that already has some interesting connotations in terms of what it signifies as a festival of lights. The juxtaposition of Hanukkah with Christmas is obvious in American society and now in other places around the world. But I think I want to pick up on this whole theme because, in essence, this is also part of the reason why we invited you to today's episode, because I really want to focus on this notion that one holiday can mean so many different things to so many different types of people. And your answer was really, I think, quite eloquent in not devaluing any of those different forms of expression. In fact, you almost elevated each one of them and then suggested, and on top of that, there should be a new one. And in some ways, I think that signifies much of your approach to being Jewish in the world today. And I wanted to ask you about that and how intentional that is around all of the work that you're doing at the moment.
Yeah, it's a big part of my work. And I think telling a good story is essential to anything we do. And Judaism has always been really good at telling stories and teaching us how to transform our stories so that they're better stories and the stories we need to tell in every different era. And I think one of the reasons you had asked earlier, why is Hanukkah such a successful holiday? Why is it so popular? One of our basic human questions is, who are my people and where do I fit in? Everybody wants to fit in. Everybody wants to feel like they belong. Where do I belong? And at Christmas, it can be really challenging, if you're not Christian, to feel like you belong. So the juxtaposition of Hanukkah with Christmas and the elevating of gelt to presents and the lights, you know, to the big electric display on your lawn is a way of answering that human need of, I need to belong too right now. We live in a very Christianized culture. And that can be very alienating if you're not Christian. So as a non-Christian, I also need to feel that I belong. And I can really see that. I have a child who's she picks up on the pervasiveness of Christianity, particularly around this time of year. And she wants to see herself reflected in the characters on the sitcoms and on the Disney Channel and in the decorations and the music she hears at school. And I think that's one reason Hanukkah has become really popular, because it serves that need of making non-Christian Jewish kids feel like, yeah, this is mine. I have a thing too.
Now, you're really touching on something here, which I think is even more significant in that response. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I do want to go there if that's where you're taking it. Some people would say the reason that Jewish holidays exist is in order to celebrate them, to perform the commandments, to perform the associated rituals with that for the sake of doing Jewish and being involved in Jewish activity.
Mm-mm.
You gave an almost oppositional response that the purpose is not for the holiday. The purpose of these holidays is actually for individuals and for them to be able to find, which is almost as a flip onto the question that we've asked several times during this podcast series of what is the purpose of being Jewish today? It's not to maintain Jewish practice. You're giving the answer. It's to maintain the health and well-being of the Jewish people or as individuals or as human beings in the world.
That's right. The entire Jewish enterprise exists for one and only one reason, in my view, and that is to create a certain kind of human being. That's its job. And it has a whole array, 613, a whole array of techniques and spiritual technologies and mechanisms to do that. And some work really well still, and some don't work so well. But we're not here to do the practices, whether or not they work. We're here to achieve the goal of the practice. And I think, by the way, that we need to do a better job of clarifying what kind of human being is this Jewish enterprise out to create. And in my view, that person, like the North Star of what we're trying to do, is a person who is deeply empathic, connected, has a sense of connection and responsibility to people around ourselves, a person who is able to tolerate ambiguity, complexity, paradox, uncertainty, who has an appetite for complexity rather than simplicity, who can perceive the hidden and not only what's on the surface, who is active rather than passive, who is challenging rather than compliant. That's Jewish tradition's idea of the human being that can walk through the world as the most fully human being possible and to create the most liberatory world for themselves and for other people. And if that's our litmus test of the goal, then all we have to do for every piece of Jewish technology is ask ourselves, is it achieving that goal? And I firmly believe that the architects of the rabbinic tradition, the rabbis, were not interested primarily in the forms of practice that achieve the goal, as long as we achieve the goal. I don't think they cared if Shabbos was on Wednesday or Saturday. I don't think they cared what we ate, as long as our eating practices, as long as our day of rest and reflection helped us work toward being that kind of human being.
This might be a good time to explain to the audience here exactly how that philosophy is embedded within Savara, the yeshiva which you founded and you're responsible for at the moment, in as much as this might be somewhat antithetical to how most people think of Jewish learning, but Savara was set up as a yeshiva in some ways to ask these questions, to challenge these norms. I mean, do you see it in that subversive role completely, or how do you see it playing out the philosophy that you just espoused as to the purpose of Jewish life?
Yeah. Savara exists to recruit a new team onto the field, to roll up their sleeves, to become players in the upgrading of the Jewish tradition, period.
I just want to be very clear. In saying that, you're suggesting that there was another team or another game going on even. So it could be a team or actually could have been a whole other game that wasn't recruiting or wasn't appealing to this generation you're trying to attract. I mean, are you being that explicit here?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Look, I'm a graduate of the Jewish Theological Seminary, to which I am immensely grateful for the education I received there. But they accepted me. They wouldn't have accepted me had they known I was a lesbian. And their ideal candidate back in the day, I can't speak for who they're looking for in their applicant pool today. But back in the day, the ideal applicant to rabbinical school in the conservative movement was the Boy Scout of Judaism. It was the kid who was in the youth group, you know, United Synagogue youth group, and went to Camp Ramah and then went to Hillel and was a product of the movement. That's who conservative Judaism thought would be the best candidate for the rabbinate. And I think they were absolutely wrong, because in an era when your tradition is working for a lot of people, that's what you do. But when your tradition is not working for a lot of people, you don't elevate into leadership the people for whom it works best. You elevate into leadership the people for whom it works least well, but who are committed to making it better. So the people you really want are the people who have been marginalized by, alienated by the tradition as it currently exists. Those people know where it's broken and they know where it needs to be fixed.
So I want to push you on this and relate the conversation also to Jewish education in terms of asking you, how broken is it? You're famous or infamous now for featuring on episodes of the Judaism Unbound podcast where you introduced the concept of the crash, that the Jewish community actually crashed. And I think by that you mean so many people had been alienated by the structures that had existed for Jewish communal life and Jewish education, and they had spoken with their feet, leading you to suggest there was actually a real crash that had occurred already. Is that the extent to which you're saying that people have felt alienated from this Jewish tradition?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not only the institutions of Judaism. It's some of the foundational values of Judaism itself that just no longer mesh with the moral intuition, what the rabbis called svara, of a lot of people. So the crash theory, in short, is the idea that all human beings share the same basic human needs and questions. Who are my people? Where do I belong? How should I live? What happens after I die? How do I love? What's right? What's wrong? And all traditions come into being for one and only one reason, to answer those questions. And they do so by means of a master story. And that's the whole ball of wax of all of the narratives and practices and traditions and holidays and values and principles that your tradition offers you. And as long as that master story, which we call Torah, if you're American, it's the American dream. As long as your master story is working for you, you're not even aware that you have questions. You don't walk around going, how should I live my life? You know, your master story tells you what's right, what's wrong. You know, your master story tells you. But ultimately and inevitably, because people grow faster than traditions, and because events happen out in the world that make elements of your master story no longer workable, and because there will always be competing stories that you will become aware of whose answers you like better, every master story will ultimately and inevitably crash. And it crashes for the queerest among us first. And what I mean by queerest here is not a person of a sexual or gender minority, although that's included in the large set of people that I'm calling queer. What I mean by queer is people who have been marginalized, people who have a profound experience of otherness with respect to, in this case, Judaism, whose experience on the margin has given them insight into what is the matter with that master story. And they walk that insight through the world as a critique on the mainstream, on the master story, in order to make it better. So once your tradition crashes, your master story crashes, you have three and only three possible responses. You can deny the crash. You could say, no, 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 that didn't happen. You revert to your master story. You embrace it. You take refuge in it. You build a wall around it to make sure no other inconvenient truths get in. And you hold on for dear life. You keep out the people who don't belong. You keep out the ideas that don't belong. And you double down on that master story. Or you say, yeah, crash happened. My master story was obviously a crock. It was awful. I'm going to completely reject my master story. And now I'm going to go off into a new story, the story of the crash material. It's throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And most people will do one of those two things, because we're taught the idea that master stories are fixed, unchanging, immutable, and eternal. That the Torah is fixed. It's always been this way. And if your life experience tells you something profound in it is wrong, whether it's the heteronormativity underneath the tradition or the misogyny or you name it, you really only then have two choices, take it or leave it. But the truth is, the rabbis way back when, who were themselves very queer in this biggest sense of being marginalized at their time, they injected into the tradition mechanisms for infinite and constant change, centered around the idea of svara, the idea that every human being has the ability to suss out what God wants. And that we now believe in a God who wants us to exercise that moral intuition, particularly when it's shaped by learning and being deeply immersed in the tradition, to upgrade the tradition. So that's the scheme that I think the rabbis were onto, and they knew crashes were going to happen in the future. And they created this giant book called the Talmud, which is really a manual for how to confront crashes in any future generation. It demonstrates how the rabbis took what was crashing in their tradition, the pieces of Torah they could no longer live with, whether it was capital punishment or lex talionis, eye for an eye, whether it was stoning the stubborn and rebellious son, you name it. And they showed us in the Talmud the techniques they use to go from that received tradition to a better tradition. And they included the techniques for messaging it out into the world, for convincing people that this is still Torah too. That view, this sort of approach, what I call traditionally radical, is at the center of our project at Svara.
I want to focus here now on the issue of Jewish education, which I think speaks well to your at least your three different alternatives that you posed there, is that many people, especially young people who have received a Jewish education, many will embrace it and they will continue their life living according to the ways they've been taught Jewishly. Two, and I think this is unfortunate, but we know it to be statistically evident, many people dislike the Jewish upbringing or the Jewish education they have and have chosen not to lead a Jewish life. And I think your third possibility is really appealing, and yet it's probably the most minimally embraced form of Jewish education. So I want to try and relate your crash theory to Jewish education specifically. And here I'm very much drawn to a quote from Proverbs, which talks about educating a child according to their way, Chanoch lenoar al pi darko, which I believe is probably the most used phrase in any Jewish education conference around the world. But if we're educating each child according to his or her way, then you would think that your third scenario is plausible and even possibly the most probable, and yet that hasn't always been the case, and it's actually really the minority case. So that's a long way of asking you to opine about how your theory applies specifically to Jewish education today. Do you think Jewish education as an enterprise has crashed? Is it on a rebirth? But let's talk to our listeners specifically now about Jewish education.
Okay, my favorite topic. So I love that teaching. There's a lot that can be learned if you look at the word chanoch, the idea of chinuch, which, yes, shares the same root as Hanukkah. And it actually is not so much about educating in the sense of transmitting information. It's about, you know, if you look it up, and I have my Jastrow dictionary right here, if you look up the root of this word, you sense that it's about initiation into preparing the person for the learning that they will do for themselves. And that's what we believe in the Svara Beit Midrash. And I think you see it in the Talmud. The Talmud is not there to tell you how to behave. The learning of Talmud is there to be a formative experience, to change you. Transformative education is really right on target with what the Talmud is there to do. It's there to make you that person who can hold uncertainty, who can hold ambiguity and paradox and complexity. That's its job. To lechanech you, that's what it means to be mechanech your students, to educate your students. It's to prepare them for the work. And we're at a moment, I think, in Jewish history, and I think it's true for every crash moment. It was true for the destruction of the Second Temple, and it's true again to the same degree now. We're at a moment where our future will probably be unrecognizable to the Jews of today. That is, we are at the beginning of reformulating and upgrading to the point where Judaism will do a better job of creating that kind of ideal human being. But the ways it's going to do it and the shift in the values that will make it that liberatory tradition it's always wanted to be are going to make Judaism very, very different. And that's going to require, to do that work is going to require people, we call them players, to be a player in that work. You have to have certain dispositions. You have to have a certain sensitivity to suffering, willingness to make change, willingness to hold your truths lightly, to own your learning and then hold it lightly, to know what you think is right, but hold it really, really lightly. And that is really what chinuch is about.
I want to try and just be a bit explicit here for the audience, because I think we've touched here on a theme that's appeared in various forms in many other episodes of this podcast. And in some ways, it depends on how you translate the word chinuch, and maybe that should be the whole podcast series in a nutshell. There's one translation in Sefaria which basically says, chanuch lenoar translates as train a lad according to the way they should go. Train a lad literally means a traditional definition of education. From one generation to another generation, give them the knowledge and the skills in order to perpetuate the ways that the previous generation has lived their lives. That's exactly what training is, and that's exactly what transmission actually means. What you're suggesting is a complete flip on that, and it's important to understand and for our listeners to ask themselves, is the purpose of Jewish education to train a younger generation to be just like the generation that came before them, which some people might loosely or crudely call Jewish continuity? Or is the purpose of Jewish education actually give people the skills and knowledge to be able to flip this Judaism thing into something which is more meaningful for the lives in which they're living today? And I think what you're signifying here is we don't have a choice, because somewhere in that discussion, the crash has already occurred. The masses have already made up their mind and gone with either option number one or number two. And if we don't go with option number three, and as Jewish educators, if we don't embrace option number three, then in fact, we're going to actually not just lose more Jews, we're going to choose number two as their option in terms of leaving completely, but many more who could find meaning are not actually going to be able to do so and will look for other pathways to do so. But I guess that's a long-winded response in terms of saying what you're actually asking of Jewish educators is actually more difficult to challenge. You actually need to know more about being Jewish, more Jewish knowledge, more Jewish wisdom in order to empower your people to be able to have those skills and capacities to do it yourself, Jewish life. The first option's easy. I've got something I want to teach you. Here's a passage of Torah or Talmud. Just learn it. What you're saying is, no, I need a whole repertoire as an educator that I can bring into the mix, because my purpose is not transmitting the text. My purpose is actually to transform lives. And that's something which is like a huge moment for Jewish educators to really try and to embrace and understand moving forward.
I think you're right. But you know what? It's not all that hard. It's not that there's so much more you need to know. There are actually very few but non-negotiable things. And I think what you need to know is, number one, you can only teach who you love, and you should only teach who you love. You got to know who you can love. You know, I'm going to confess that there aren't that many people I can love, but I know who I can love. I know the group of people I can love. And those are the people that we let into our yeshiva. I think it's just not nice to let people into your classroom or your Beit Midrash if you already know that you cannot love them. And you can't love them if you don't deeply understand them and know something profound about their profound life experience. So at a certain point, we realize there's some magic happening at Svara. Let's reverse engineer it, figure out what is going on here, because then we could train other teachers to create the magic and create lots more magic in the world. So I remember, maybe 5-6 years ago, I called up one of my students and I said, help me think about it. Like, help me think about the elements of the method that we use, so that I can articulate them to teach other people how to do it. Like, what are the steps that we're doing? And you know what they said to me? This person uses they, them. They said to me, Vinay, it's not about the method. It's about how you look at us. What they meant was every student in that Beit Midrash can feel that I love them. They feel seen. They feel loved. They feel respected. They know that I think they're important. And they know that I think they can do this really, really, really hard thing. And they know that I think that they're essential in creating that next Jewish future. That's really all the teacher has to have. Let's say you're teaching Talmud. The Talmud is this, you know, multi-thousand page document with one point. The tradition is infinitely flexible. You are empowered to change it, own it, know it, so that you can play with it with respect and make it better. And it tells that same story over and over and over 100 times on every page. So you don't actually need to know that much.
So I don't want to lose sight of that last point, because you're basically saying the purpose of the Talmud is to reinvent itself or to reinvent the people around it. Pause, mic drop, like, that's all good for us to hear. But I do want to just go back to something you just said about loving the student, because I think this is really important. And I want to give you a chance to explain yourself in this other framework. You get the chance at Savara and your Beit Midrash to select your students, or in some ways they're self-selecting. Most of the Jewish educators out here are given the kids that they're given, school setting or a camp setting. And, you know, between you and me, some of those campers or those students aren't always the ones that you naturally want to love. What's the message here you're really giving about loving the student? Because I think there's something deeper here that it's more than respect. And here you're using the word love in a really profound and deep way.
Okay, I'm going to back up. I'm going to answer this question with a longer story. A number of years ago, I was invited to teach a group of rabbis and Jewish educators who were in a teacher training program. They were learning how to teach text better. And I went around the table and I asked them, about their learning background. And every single one of them loved learning Talmud. And I asked them if they taught Talmud. They all said, yes, they do. And I said, how do you teach it? Long story short, they all teach in translation. And at Svar, we only learn in the original Hebrew and Aramaic. Never, never, never in translation. The way we make learning accessible is not by dumbing it down or giving it to people in English, but by making it very, very easy to access the original. And I realized that Jewish educators tend to have four fallacies in their mind when it comes to teaching, which made me realize, why is it that we actually don't teach as Jewish educators the way we love to learn? I'll bet you love to sit down with a text in the original with your chevruta, to spend a luxurious amount of time in a small amount of text explore. I bet you love that. Am I right?
You are right.
Right.
I don't do it enough, but I love it when I get the chance to do it.
Right. We all love it because it's exhilarating. It's joyful. It creates this amazing sense of flow in God and being fully present. It's amazing. But why don't we teach that way? I think it's the four fallacies that teachers often hold unknowingly. They're usually not conscious of them. One, I love learning in this thick, rigorous, deep, engaging way, but they won't. Number two, I can do this. I can learn in this really serious, challenging way, but they're not going to be able to. Three, it's important that people like me, rabbis, Jewish educators, leaders, it's important that we roll up our sleeves and are involved sitting at the table and learning this way. It's not important that they are. And fourth, even if I wanted to, I could never teach in the way that is powerful for me because I don't have the expertise. And at Svara, we believe that to be a good teacher is to be a learner in front of the room who makes their learning transparent. The best teacher is the best learner who's willing to make their learning transparent. And no teacher walks in front of the room at Svara owning the text they're about to teach more than 80%. We have the 80-20 rule. If you have a lock on what you're teaching more than 80%, you shouldn't be teaching because it's not real. It's like you're pretending. The magic is only going to happen if you are really authentically learning and you really authentically need those students to be there for you. And you're only going to do that if you really trust them, believe them, have confidence in them, respect them, know that they have something valuable to bring.
Who is wise? The one who learns from everybody else.
Yeah.
I want to ask you a specific question here about a topic that I know you've thought a lot about. As I said, we are leading into the days and we'll be listening to this or dropping this podcast during the Festival of Hanukkah. You've already spoken a bit about the element of pride when it comes to Hanukkah, the mitzvah, the commandment, or the tradition of putting your menorah, your Hanukkah, in the window so that everybody outside can see and that you're proud to exhibit your Jewishness to the world. And I'm often asked this question. I'm wondering what your thoughts are. How do you teach Jewish pride? How do you teach pride in general? Because I think it's something that we as educators all strive for, but it's a bit amorphous in some way, like we're commanded to love in the same way we're commanded to be proud. How do you educate towards being proud?
It's actually easy. You have to tell a story about Judaism that's more compelling than the story most of us were taught. You have to tell a story in which the architects of our tradition were just like you, who felt as alienated as you, who had insights from being outsiders just like you, you know, who were the underdogs just like you, who were essential and valuable, without whom we wouldn't exist today. What I do is tell a story that is, as I said earlier, one of a traditionally radical past. I tell the story of the rabbis as the queer folk of their generation, the outsiders, the marginalized people with no power, who had the chutzpah, who had the courage and audacity to insert the values that their lived life experiences told them were non-negotiable. And they inserted those into the tradition and they said, that's Jewish. And I tell people that process of upgrading the tradition based on your insight from being on the margin. That's the most Jewish thing about being Jewish. That process of upgrading the tradition is the most traditional thing about our tradition. Now, all of a sudden, I, as the student, now all of a sudden, I'm proud because you've just made me the hero of the Jewish story. You've made me important. You've made me essential. You've told me a story about the tradition in which I actually am trusted. And I never knew I was trusted. This idea of Svara, why didn't anybody ever teach it to me? That idea has been in the tradition for 2,000 years. The idea that my moral intuition is equal to Torah for the rabbis. It is de'oraita, straight from Torah. And any innovation that comes out of your Svara has the same status as Torah. If I had ever been taught that in Hebrew school, my life would have been completely different. As a queer kid coming out in the 70s, if I had known that that voice inside of me that said, B'nai, this is the truth of who you are, even though your parents, your tradition, Judaism, the world around you says you are supposed to be something else, you're supposed to be straight, but I should listen to my inner voice. If someone had taught me that that impulse has a Jewish word, it's called Svara, and that listening to it is actually what I'm commanded to do, and that I'm commanded to overturn Torah based on that Svara, that would have been very powerful. And that would have made me feel a lot better about Judaism altogether. So I'm a little bit on a mission to make sure every Hebrew school kid comes out of Hebrew school not only knowing, you know, Tikkun Olam and Tzedakah and Shabbat, but also this concept of Svara. So telling people a story that makes them proud of their past. And there's a lot to be proud of in the tradition, but it just hasn't been surfaced. I think we haven't elevated the right stories.
So I hope you don't mind me asking this question, but I'm going to ask you and then I'm going to ask you related to educators as well. By the sounds of your own biography, by every description you've given so far, you probably should have taken option number two, just walked away. You chose option number three to pave a way for yourself. And I guess I'm asking the question, what's the message for either educators or for young people today who take a stance that might not always be popular, the pushback that they might receive, what level of conviction, what level of pride do they really need to know that they're taking the right stance? But what's the message, perhaps from your own biography, that you could give to teachers and to students to say, embrace this change because this actually is your role in the world and not something else that might have been preordained by somebody else?
Well, first thing I want to say is I didn't initially go option three. And people often choose one and two or first one and then two before they go option three. And I went option two for a long time. I moved to Japan for a decade where I became a very devout Buddhist. And I hung out in option two land for a long time. And I actually think that's a necessary and healthy move before you can really go option three. Option two, they're like, you know what? I'm out of here. This is not working for me. It's not necessarily a bad move. It can be the place where we regroup and clarify who we are and find the values that are really important to us and find the people who are important to us and experience that discomfort that comes from, oh, wow, there's something about my past that I'm missing. That's a really important insight. You know, when I was in rabbinical school, I started a little Hebrew school to pay my tuition. And the parents would ask me, B'nai, what are you going to teach my kids? What's your goal for my kids? And I would say, my goal for your kids is that when they go off and become a Buddhist, at some point, they're going to start to feel guilty because they're going to feel that their Jewishness somehow, they're going to be uncomfortable having left it, and they're going to need to resolve that discomfort. And then they're going to come back, and with their adult minds, they're going to explore Judaism, and then, you know, hopefully they'll find a place like Svara or a bunch of other places where they're going to find the traditionally radical, amazing past. So I think my advice is I started to feel uncomfortable and needed to come back to resolve what felt like I am Jewish. You know, like it or not like it, that's who I am. It's not something I can set down like I can set a suitcase down. Jewish is who I am. So, in short, we need to give our kids the sense of Jewish is who you are. That's you. And there are a lot of different ways to do that. It doesn't have to be day school and it doesn't have to be Hebrew school. There are a lot of ways to make sure kids feel like that's who I am.
This does indeed remind me of the article that I wrote but never published advocating for the Jewish Rumspringer.
Yeah.
Which is the Amish version of giving kids after they graduate from the equivalent of high school a year to go and find themselves without the lifestyle of the Amish community and then bank on the fact that more of them are going to come back than leave, which statistically, by the way, does prove to be true. It might do a bit of collateral damage on the side, but it's an interesting argument to put forward that the way to actually gain greater affinity is actually to break away for a bit and to discover oneself in that time.
And not only that, what you bring back. Once you go option two, if you come back, you bring all sorts of goodies that you've discovered from the world around you. You know, I joke with my students that if you go option two and then you come back, you know what we get? We get yoga minions. And that's how Judaism has upgraded itself since forever. That's how it works. And we Judaize the wonderful spiritual techniques that we learn from the world around us.
It's a really great reminder for many of us who often try and see the work that we do in the Jewish education space as needing to close ourselves off from the external influences, which might be distracting or have negative influences. And in some ways you're saying, well, the exact opposite is true, partly because you can't control the outside world and partly because we should just embrace it because that is the lives of the people that we're trying to impact and what positivity they can bring back into the Jewish world from bringing in those experiences. I am reminded of the story that I tell as I walked. I was observing a congregational school one day, and the kid comes into school dressed in their baseball uniform because they just come back from baseball practice. And the first thing the teacher asked them to do is change and into regular clothes, get out of their baseball uniform, because you don't bring baseball into the Jewish learning environment. And I'm looking at this situation really like, you just don't get it. Like, this is our moment in life to embrace the kids' love of baseball and to bring that into the Jewish environment rather than saying there's a time and a space for them to be separate from those different aspects of their identity. We are reaching the end of our time together, and I do want to ask you the question which I ask all of my guests and give you an opportunity to pay tribute to an educator who made a difference in your life. Is there somebody who you're able to shout out at this point in the podcast?
Yeah, I think that person was my eighth grade social studies teacher, Roger LaRosse. And he was that person for me for a couple of reasons. Number one, he treated us and me with respect. And, you know, when I was 13 and in eighth grade, I got diagnosed with a certain bone disease. I'm fine and it wasn't super serious, but I couldn't do it. I was a very tomboyish athletic kid, and I could no longer do athletics. I couldn't ride a bike anymore. And I was pretty bummed. And with my parents' permission, he took me out of school one day and he took me to the public library where he guided me through the medical textbooks to do research on this disease that I had just gotten diagnosed with. You know, that's just an example of how he cared. He cared about me. I was a person, you know, that wasn't in his curriculum. And he taught us how to think, not what to think, but how to think. He taught us how to be analytical thinkers, how to be critical thinkers. And I think that has really shaped me as a person and what I think is really important for a teacher.
Bene, thank you so much for today's episode. That was filled with so many insightful pieces and nuggets that I wasn't quite expecting, and I wasn't fully knowing where the conversation was going, but it took us into delightful arenas for Jewish life and for Jewish education that I'm really so grateful for you being able to expose our listeners to much of your thinking and to emphasize many of the points that we have been raising over the course of this podcast in the last few weeks. So thank you very much for joining us here today.
David, thank you so much. This was such a joy and really an honor. Thank you.
Next week, we'll be continuing this discussion somewhat by talking about the role of spirituality in Jewish education with Rabbi Josh Fagelson and Michal Fox-Smart of the Jewish Institute for Spirituality. Adapting the Future of Jewish Education, the production of the Jewish Education Project. Today's episode was produced by Dina Nussenbaum and Gabriel Weinstein. The show's executive producers are myself, Karen Cummins, and Nessa Lieben. Our show is engineered and edited by Nathan J. Vaughan of NJV Media. If you enjoyed today's episode even half as much as I did, please make sure you go onto Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and to share this podcast with a friend. You can also subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it and be the first to know when new episodes are released. Of course, you can learn more about the Jewish Education Project when you visit jewishedproject.org. You can learn about our history, our staff, and the work that we do, and learn about our great partner, the UJA Federation of New York, who supports us in all of our endeavors. I want to wish you all a happy Hanukkah, and thank you all for listening.